the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day. Hello, this is Patrick Georgioff.
And I'm Ian Kratzky.
And we are thrilled to introduce Behind the Knife's Surgical Critical Care Review.
Yeah, this has been a long time coming. Finally, a resource for surgical intensivists and trainees.
Exactly. This resource gives residents, fellows, and junior attendings everything they need to learn the art and the science of critical care and to confidently manage the sickest patients in the hospital.
We've included podcasts, an AI simulator, and a comprehensive question bank.
Yeah, the podcasts span the full SCORE curriculum for critical care. The AI cases test your judgment against our one-of-a-kind simulator. And the Q-Bank includes over 500 rigorous, board-style, multiple-choice questions that will sharpen your performance on both rounds and on exam day.
So visit behindtheknife.org for more information. Remember, you can access this and all the BTK content on our app as well.
We hope you enjoy this critical care episode.
And dominate the ICU.
Behind the Knife, surgical critical care. Dominate the ICU.
Welcome back to Behind the Knife Surgical Critical Care Review. I'm Ian Kratzky, trauma, acute care, and critical care attending.
And I'm Paul, one of the UNC fellows. All right, Ian, what
you
are we getting
in? Paul, actually.
I was.
What are you now? Man.
I'm just this weird intermediate fellow to attending role now, so it's kind of fun.
Well,
but for this episode, I'm super honored to have you or have had you as an attending and now as a colleague, Dr. Kratzky.
Excellent.
But the big question is, what are we going to get into today?
Well, Paul, today we're going to dive into the murky waters of liver failure, how to recognize it, how to manage it, and how to keep your head above water when everything starts turning yellow.
Funny, I see what you did there, bud. But this is an important topic for surgeons. We generally try to avoid operating on patients with failing livers, but sometimes we don't have a choice. And regardless, we're going to have to take care of these patients in the ICU anyways.
That's exactly right, Paul. So today we'll work through a case, hit the major physiology and management points, and finish with some rapid-fire pearls as always. Ready?
Ready.
All right, let's get into it. So, Paul, you're called to see a 62-year-old male with history of hypertension and long-standing heavy alcohol use.
Just as a side, what's defined heavy for me? I'm just asking for a friend.
Yeah, I see there. Well, for our purposes, let's say six-pack every day for the last 30 years. He presents with fever and a painful bulge around his umbilicus. His temp is 38.5, heart rate 105, and blood pressure is 105 over 62. He's got a white count of 17, his creatinine's 1.03, bilirubin 6.2 with an INR of 2, and luckily his lactate is normal. On exam, he looks unwell, but he's awake and oriented. He has clear scleral icterus, a protuberant abdomen with a positive fluid wave, and a reducible umbilical hernia with moderate tenderness, but no overlying skin changes. The ED already got a CT that shows moderate ascites, a nodular liver consistent with cirrhosis. He also has abdominal wall varices and an umbilical hernia containing fat with a little bit of surrounding stranding. So, Paul, given all this, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I'm just glad that umbilical hernia is reducible. But based on everything you said, the imaging and the exam clearly, you know, suggests chronic liver disease. But now he has an acute illness on top of it. So I'm worried about ACLF or that acute on chronic liver failure.
Good. Well, before we get there, let's just review what the liver actually does and what starts going wrong when it fails. Tell me, Paul.
Yeah, no, we got to learn a little bit about that before we get into it, right? But as we know, the liver does quite a little bit of everything. It regulates metabolism and glucose homeostasis. So severe liver failure can eventually cause hypoglycemia. It metabolizes medications and toxins, and it helps clear ammonia, which becomes important when we talk about hepatic encephalopathy. It also synthesizes albumin and both pro- and anticoagulant proteins. It produces bile, and it plays an important role in immune function. So when the liver fails, you can see everything from jaundice and edema to altered mental status, infection, and major abnormalities in hemostasis.
Perfect. So how do you divide up liver failure?
Yeah, you got to divide up more so the three buckets is how I look at it. So acute liver failure is one, chronic liver failure is the other, and then lastly, the acute on chronic liver failure, like I discussed earlier. The acute liver failure was the rapid development of liver dysfunction in someone without known cirrhosis, and classically with coagulopathy and hepatic encephalopathy. That chronic liver failure is the progressive disease we see with cirrhosis, which can be, of course, compensated or decompensated. And then obviously that last one, that ACLF, a patient is with underlying chronic liver disease who sustains an acute insult and rapidly develops decompensation with one or more organ failures.
Yeah, exactly. Scary stuff there. Tell me, what are some of the big causes of acute liver failure?
Yeah, broadly speaking, I like to think of toxins, infections, and essentially everything else. Acetaminophen toxicity is the most common cause in the United States, while viral hepatitis remains important worldwide. And other causes include autoimmune hepatitis, Budd-Chiari syndrome, pregnancy-related liver disease, and of course, ischemic hepatitis.
Yeah. Well, ACLF is a little different because these patients really can deteriorate incredibly quickly.
Absolutely. You know, the infection is a major trigger, but GI bleeding, alcohol-associated hepatitis, medications, of course, and other acute insults can all precipitate it. So the prognosis worsens dramatically as, unfortunately, each organ system dies or fails.
Yeah, that brings us nicely to the CLIF-C ACLF score. Can you tell me about it?
Yeah, the CLIF-C, it's not something you jump off. ACLF incorporates several organ failures. It includes liver, kidney, brain, coagulation, circulation, and respiratory dysfunction, all things you would expect with somebody with that type of pathology. And it essentially estimates short-term mortality. The EASL CLIF data, they're pretty striking. It shows that mortality rises sharply as organ failure accumulates, which is, you know, why the score is most useful when followed serially rather than, you know, treated as one-time number, you know, and everything in the ICU, we got to follow trends versus, you know, numbers in isolation.
Right.
But just to go back to you, and I don't think you need to memorize the formula. The pearl is that ACLF is a multi-system disease and that, of course, trajectory matters.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously more organs failing equals worsening mortality. So let's get back to our patient here. Why are you so worried about ACLF in him?
Yeah, he has a clear evidence of chronic liver disease. He's got the ascites like you talked about, the varices, and then a nodular liver that you talked about on the CT scan. And now he's febrile with a white count and, you know, possible intra-abdominal infection. In a cirrhotic patient with ascites, I'm always thinking about SBP or spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. And that definitely needs to be on our differential when we're thinking about this guy.
Yep, totally. All right, let's talk workup. On exam, I'm looking for jaundice, ascites, asterixis, and any change in mental status. What about labs? Which of them matter most?
Yeah, so actual liver function, you know, we think about LFTs or AST and LLTs, but really bilirubin and INR are the most useful. AST and ALT are really markers of hepatocellular injury, not function. And they can be dramatically elevated in somebody with acute injury and relatively unimpressive with somebody with advanced cirrhosis.
Yeah, that's a really important distinction, Paul. We call them liver function tests, but they don't necessarily tell you how well the liver is functioning. It's kind of annoying. What about ammonia?
Yeah, so hepatic encephalopathy is primarily a clinical diagnosis. Of course, the ammonia contributes to that pathophysiology, but the absolute level correlates poorly with severity of encephalopathy. So an elevated ammonia can support the picture, but it shouldn't replace your clinical assessment or stop you from looking for other causes of altered mental status. I want to say one important nuance in acute liver failure Very high arterial ammonia levels do carry prognostic information for cerebral edema and intracranial hypertension. So, in that context, it does matter.
Yeah. All right. Well, what other labs are you going to send?
Yeah, we're going to send the gamut. So, of course, a CBC, a CMP, coag studies as well, glucose, lactate. And depending on the presentation, I think a viral hepatitis studies and acetaminophen level is also warranted. I also want cultures if infection is suspected. You're going to do that same infectious workup with anybody. And then with anyone with cirrhosis plus ascites and acute decompensation, I would have a very low threshold for a diagnostic paracentesis.
Yep, perfect. What about some viscoelastic testing? Is there any role for getting TEG or Rotem?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, especially, we alluded to possibly doing a procedure. So if you are considering a procedure, one of the most important concepts in cirrhosis is that these patients are not simply, quote unquote, auto anticoagulated. The failing liver produces fewer procoagulant factors, but it also produces fewer natural anticoagulants like protein C, protein S, and antithrombin. The result is a fragile balanced hemostatic system that can tip toward either bleeding or thrombosis. And there is randomized data behind, like you said, Ian, the viscoelastic testing here. Specifically, David Petrie and colleagues, they showed that the TEG-guided transfusion substantially reduced prophylactic blood product use before invasive procedures without increasing bleeding complications, which is
Yeah,
nice.
totally. That's why an INR of, say, 2 in a cirrhotic patient does not mean the same thing as an INR of 2 in somebody taking warfarin.
Bingo. And that's why we shouldn't reflexively transfuse plasma just to normalize that INR. If the patient is actively bleeding or needs an invasive procedure, use the entire picture. And when available, use your TEG or your viscoelastic testing, like you talked about, to target blood product replacement.
Yeah, and that same concept goes for VTE prophylaxis. An elevated INR by itself is not a reason to hold chemoprophylaxis.
Music to my ears, man. Yeah, cirrhotic patients can still develop PVs and DVTs. So holding prophylaxis for the same reasons you would in other critically ill patients. So the one that's actively bleeding or has severe thrombocytopenia, when clinically relevant. Or another true contraindication, not simply because the INR is elevated.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point here to nail that just because someone has cirrhosis does not mean you get to hold their DVT prophylaxis. They're actually at higher risk for blood clots. All right. So for our patient here, we're worried about ACLF. You said it's probably triggered by some sort of infection. What are some scoring systems that can help us with prognosis for this patient, as well as, say, surgical risk?
Yeah, this is my favorite. Just putting it to MD Calc. Everyone should know, at least the best known one is MELD, your MELD score. So today, transplant allocation in the United States uses the MELD 3.0, which, as most of us know, incorporates bilirubin, INR, creatinine, sodium, albumin, and gender or sex. Its main role is essentially estimating short-term mortality and helping prioritize liver transplant allocation.
Yeah, and for the surgeon deciding whether somebody can tolerate an operation, what are you going to use there?
Yeah, my other favorite scoring system is the Child-Pugh score. So, still commonly discussed, it incorporates similar things, your bilirubin, your albumin, your INR, and then some other stuff, more subjective. So, your ascites or encephalopathy, and divides patients into three classes, your A, B, and C, obviously C being the worst. In general, operative risk substantially increases as you move towards that C level. But I wouldn't use any single score in isolation. You know, the urgency of operation, degree of portal hypertension, the presence of ACLF, and other organ failures all matter.
Exactly. Yep. Elective surgery in a severely decompensated cirrhotic is a very different conversation from, say, source control for a perforated viscus.
Absolutely.
So, Paul, anything else that you'd like from an imaging standpoint?
Yeah, I think most of the imaging studies we have are pretty good, but something else we could add is an ultrasound. I think that can be very useful. It can evaluate liver morphology, biliary dilation, ascites, and then when, that Doppler component is added, you can take a look at your portal and hepatic vascular flow. And whether you need it depends on the clinical question, but it's good imaging to have if you already have it.
Yeah, totally. All right, back to our patient. He's febrile and now becoming hypotensive. What's your first move?
Yeah, back to the basics, man.
Oh, yeah.
ABC.
Sing it.
Let's do it. I'm a Michael Jackson fan. If your encephalopathy is severe enough that he can't protect his airway, of course, address that early, simple stuff. And then, assess your perfusion, get your cultures if you hadn't already, start appropriate antibiotics, and resuscitate the shock.
Yeah. How are you thinking about fluids though in cirrhosis?
Super carefully. I mean, just like with any patient, but more so in these particular groups. These patients are, as we know, intravascularly depleted while also being massively overloaded. So I'd give fluid when it's indicated, of course, but I'm recessing frequently rather than just blindly chasing a number or their urine output. And I'd be careful not to oversell albumin. I think we talk about that a lot in these situations as a default resuscitated fluid for every cirrhotic patient. The evidence is strongest in specific indications, and that is SVP, large volume paracentesis, and patients with hepatorenal syndrome. The classic SORT trial in SVP showed that adding albumin to antibiotics reduced renal dysfunction and mortality, which is why we stick to that indication. But other than those stuff that we talked about, we shouldn't just always be giving them albumin. We can also utilize crystalloid.
Yeah, that distinction is important. Albumin isn't automatically the resuscitation fluid for, say, every hypotensive cirrhotic patient. It is one of the few patient populations that albumin is actually potentially beneficial in sepsis. But as you said, there are specific subcategories of the cirrhotic patients where the data shows it helps. Let's say this guy's already received some crystalloid and some albumin. His MAP's 58. What's next?
Yeah, I'm going to do some of the other adjuncts that we all do for all our critical care patients and go back and do a bedside exam. I'd grab that ultrasound, do a POCUS, and make sure that additional volume is actually going to help, although we know that may be difficult with these patients with the substantial ascites. But if he remains hypotensive despite adequate resuscitation, I mean, we're going to have to start reaching for a pressor. And
Yeah.
for me, that would be norepi.
First line.
Exactly. And if norepi requirements continue to climb, vasopressin is a reasonable second agent.
Yep, totally. How about one of my favorite drugs, N-acetylcysteine or NAC? Any role for it here?
Yeah, Ian, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of times in this scenario, we think about acetaminophen-associated liver failure is when we start it. And of course, I'd start empirically if there's any meaningful possibility of that type of toxicity rather than just waiting for the entire work to come back. So, simple question, yes, I would love to start that. I think you should. There's also randomized data suggesting NAC improves transplant-free survival in selected patients with early stage non-acetaminophen-associated acute liver failure, particularly those with lower grade encephalopathy. So, this is one of those therapies where obviously time is of the essence, and the earlier you start it, the better.
Totally. I think if you're even wondering whether you should start it, benefit probably outweighs risk here to start if there's any question that they have Tylenol toxicity. So let's say over the next 24 hours or so, his hemodynamics improve, but his bilirubin and INR continue to rise. The nurse calls you and says he's not waking up like he was yesterday. What are you doing?
Yeah, I'm going to sprint over there and see him first thing. And then we're going to do the same formula we always do, guys. So you do your ABCs. And then if he's protecting his airway, that's the next first question I'm going to ask. And then whether or not his hepatic encephalopathy or something else entirely is happening. So looking for hypoglycemia, hypercapnia, infection, of course. Is there a medication that we've given him that's affecting him? Did he have a stroke, seizure, or any type of electrolyte disturbance? So it's everything. Essentially, do the same workup for any patient with altered sensorium at bedside.
Yeah. Well, let's say his GCS is 9, your ammonia came back elevated, and this morning his sodium unfortunately has fallen from 135 yesterday to 124.
Yikes. Yeah, that acute sodium drop definitely gets my attention, especially with neurologic change. I'd manage that symptomatic hyponatremia carefully, most likely with hypertonic saline. And then we're going to do frequent sodium checks, close neurologic monitoring, and appropriate imaging if I'm worried about any other intracranial process. So, low threshold to send them down for the scanner. One caution, though, these patients are usually chronically hyponatremic and cirrhotic, and Malnourished patients are among the highest risk groups for osmotic demyelination. So I'm going to very carefully limit correction to no more than 8 milliequivalents per liter in 24 hours.
Yeah. And what about cerebral edema?
Yeah, that's also another important tidbit in acute liver failure. So I'm going to be worried about intracranial hypertension doing the same stuff that we do for our trauma patients, elevating the head of the bed, avoiding fever, hypoxemia, managing that sodium, like we just talked about, anosmolarly carefully, and then involving, if we're not at a transplant center, getting them called or on the phone early. And then if we have access to it, if you have a neurosurgeon, maybe some invasive ICP monitoring, but that's more controversial because these patients are obviously coagulopathic. So it's generally reserved for, highly selected cases at experienced centers.
Yep, totally. All right. So, what if, say, his sodium's fine? You get some imaging, it's reassuring, and this really does look like hepatic encephalopathy. What's next?
All right, that's a little bit more reassuring. So then I'm looking for treating the precipitating cause. What is causing his AMS? So, because hepatic encephalopathy rarely happens for no reason. So, I'm going to be thinking about infection, GI bleed, is it constipation, dehydration, renal failure, once I get medications, and then, of course, looking over those electrolyte abnormalities. And then for severity, the West Haven criteria are the standard language that we use. Grade one is the subtle attention and sleep-wake changes. Grade two brings lethargy, disorientation, and esterichthys. And in grade three is somnolence to stupor with marked confusion. And then lastly, grade four is coma. So at that point, we start talking about whether or not we should start lactulose on some of these patients.
How's that work?
Yes, I'm glad you asked. So it acidifies the colon and converts ammonia into ammonium, which is less readily absorbed. So that's how we get it out. And clinically, I think the more important thing is the endpoint of when you stop doing it. I remember, I don't know if it was you, Ian, or actually one of the other attendings, but you asked me specifically, when do you want to stop? And you have to titrate this to, the patient having about 2 to 3, soft bowel movements per day.
Yeah, you can definitely overdo it. What if the patient can't take things orally? We certainly have our post-op bowel surgery patients. What are you going to do then?
Yeah, if they can, and also too, if they're too altered to take anything by mouth, obviously if
Certainly.
they have some sort of, enteral tube, NG tube, OG, if they're still intubated, you can use rectal lactulose. That's another good option. And then for recurrent, hepatic encephalopathy, rifaximin is another adjunct that's commonly added. We can actually discuss the landmark BAS trial, which showed about 58% relative reduction in breakthrough encephalopathy over 6 months. And then fewer hepatic encephalopathy-related hospitalizations, although more than 90% of those patients were also receiving lactulose. So it's kind of difficult to discern which did it. But practically speaking, rifaximin is a good add-on, but not a replacement for lactulose.
Perfect. All right. So bring this case together for us, Paul. What's your template for dealing patients with liver failure?
Yeah, so it's start off first, determine what you're dealing with, what type of flavor of the liver failure you got. Is it acute? Is it chronic decompensated cirrhosis? Or is it that ACLF? Then identify and treat the precipitating insult. So specifically, most time in the SICU, it's going to be infection, but you're also going to have other things like bleeding, toxins, or ischemia. After that, the management is largely meticulous critical care. Support, perfusion, protect the airway when necessary, manage the encephalopathy, avoid unnecessary correction of the INR, treat infections early, and support any other failing organ systems. And if the patient is acute liver failure or severe ACLF, involve a transplant center early. In acute liver failure, specifically the King's College criteria, that's a classic tool for identifying who needs urgent transplant evaluation. One set for acetaminophen toxicity and other for everything else. So, like I talked about earlier in the episode, don't wait until every other option has failed before making that phone call.
Exactly. Yeah. If they're not a transplant candidate, you continue and they continue to develop progressive multi-organ failure. That's also when early and honest goals of care conversations become super important because these patients can deteriorate fast. And sometimes palliative care or just good family conversations may play a role here. All
Absolutely.
right. I think we've covered the big picture, but liver failure comes with a whole host of complications, doesn't it? So let's finish off with some rapid fire scenarios you're likely to encounter in the ICU. Paul, you ready?
Yes, sir. You know it.
All right. Paterino syndrome. What's the treatment?
Albumin plus vasoconstricted therapy. Terlipressin is now the best studied pharmacologic option for HRS-AKI, and norepi remains a very reasonable ICU alternative. So terlipressin has also been an FDA approved in the United States since, 2022? Mm-hmm. So it's no longer just a, fancy European therapy. We can use it. And in the confirmed trial, terlipressin verified that hepatorenal syndrome reversal compared with placebo. Mm-hmm. But Ian, there is one important trade-off: more serious respiratory adverse events, including respiratory failure. So patient selection and volume status really matters.
Yep. Well said. All right. What about hepatopulmonary syndrome? What's that?
Yeah. So intrapulmonary vascular dilation, the setting of liver disease leading to impaired oxygenation and shunting. Contrast-enhanced echocardiography can demonstrate delayed appearance of bubbles in the left heart. So that supports intrapulmonary shunt.
And you find that, what's the treatment?
Just supplemental oxygen as needed, but unfortunately the big thing is going to be liver transplant, and that's the only definitive therapy.
All right. Cirrhotic patient with an upper GI bleed. What are you thinking about?
Yeah, first thing is definitely a variceal hemorrhage until proven otherwise. So like all of these bad bleeds, we resuscitate. We can start a vasoactive agent such as octreotide. You can give prophylactic antibiotics in these patients and get urgent endoscopy for definitive therapy. Like we talked about early in the episode, don't overtransfuse these patients. Restrictive red cell strategy with normally hemoglobin target from 7 to 8 is generally preferred because excessive transfusion, as we know, can increase those portal pressures. And if bleeding can't be controlled endoscopically, we got balloon tamponade, an esophageal stent to serve as a bridge to definitive therapy, which is most often TIPS.
Yep. And little plug here for our episode on GI bleeding. Check it out. We'll talk more about that. How are you going to transfuse these patients, Paul?
Just like with the fluids, man, judiciously. Avoid chasing that INR with plasma. Use, like I said, that restrictive red cell strategy when appropriate. Correct your fibrinogen or platelets when it's indicated, and then use TEG or Rotem or your other vasoelastic tests that you have at your institution. And the goal is hemostasis, not normalization of every abnormal lab value.
Yeah, well said. What about infection?
Yeah, have a low threshold to look for it and treat it early, just like in health things, sepsis, right? Mm-hmm. Infection is a major driver of that decompensation in ACLF and cirrhosis. So, definitely act on it quick.
Yep. Highest cause mortality in these patients. Diagnostic criterion for SPP.
Acidic fluid, absolute neutrophil count of at least 250 cells per cubic meter. And if you diagnose SPP, remember the evidence-based pairing, antibiotics plus albumin in appropriate patients to reduce the risk of renal failure and death.
Awesome. What's your management for an agitated cirrhotic patient?
Intubate them. Just kidding. First, figure out why they're agitated, guys. Just like you do with anything in medicine, go there, investigate, avoid benzos. Do not reach for those when possible, unless you're treating somebody with alcohol withdrawal. If medication is necessary, use the lowest effective dose. And remember that hepatic dysfunction can prolong the effects of many sedatives that you give them.
Totally. This may be a place where your pharmacist comes in handy because a lot of these meds are hepatically cleared. All right. That'll do it for today. And if there's one thing to remember, it's that liver failure is never just a liver problem.
Exactly. These patients develop circulatory failure, kidney injury, encephalopathy, infection, bleeding, and thrombosis, and sometimes all of those at once. Sure. Your job is to identify the trigger, support the failing organs, and recognize early when the patient needs that transplant-level care.
Yep. Well, thanks for listening to another episode of Behind the Knife Surgical Critical Care Review. As always, Paul.
Sir?
Dominate the day.
Dominate the day.
Let's do it again. Can we do it at the same time?
Okay.
Okay.
What's going to be your tell? You're going to say Paul and then right after that?
Yeah, thanks for listening. And Paul, dominate the day. Got it?
Got it.
All right. Well, thanks for listening to another episode of Behind the Knife Surgical Critical Care Review. And as always, Paul,
dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple iOS and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.